our Bibles again to Esther chapter 4. I think last time I was, well, perhaps not last time I was here, but a little while ago we looked at Esther chapter 3. And we saw there Haman the Agagite and him being this enemy of God's people and ultimately a picture of Satan, who is the perennial, the universal enemy of God's people at all times. But this morning we're looking at Esther chapter 4. And as I said at the beginning of our series, I'll just state it again this morning that, of course, it's a well-known fact that the name of God is never explicitly mentioned in this book. The word God is never used. And as I said before, this isn't something that we should be embarrassed about as Christians. We shouldn't think that the book of Esther is any sort of less a book of the Bible because it doesn't mention God's name. And I say that because the book of Esther, or the author of the book of Esther, hasn't sort of accidentally forgotten about God. He's not accidentally omitted God from the text. Rather, it's the deliberate design of the author not to mention God. And that's particularly obvious in chapter 4, because there are many occasions in this chapter we've just read where, frankly, it would have been easier to have mentioned God than not to have mentioned God. And yet it looks like, at times, the author is at great pains to actually avoid referencing the name of God. And what's the reason for that, then? Well, I think the reason for that is that if the author had mentioned God, which would have been completely legitimate, of course, it would have perhaps distracted us away from the very point of the book of Esther. You see, if God is mentioned sort of once in this chapter and again in this chapter and over here, then we might come away with the impression of a God who most of the time kind of stands back and lets history develop, but then very occasionally jumps in and sort of gives history a little sort of nudge, or does a little intervention over here, or a little miracle over there. And of course, God does jump in and do miracles throughout history and displays himself in the most supernatural and extraordinary ways. But in the book of Esther, by very obviously not mentioning God, the author directs our eyes away from sort of this idea of a little kind of intervention here and a little moment there, and rather we recognize that the God of the book of Esther is one who is in charge of the whole chain of history. He is a God which is presiding over every little detail which takes place. He works through the very events of history. It's not that the supernatural purposes of God occasionally interrupt history to get it back on the right lines. No, rather it's that the purposes of God hover over the whole of history and command the natural chain of events to take place. And as I said then, in this chapter, God's implicit presence is particularly conspicuous by his explicit absence. What I mean by that is there's very obviously a God-shaped hole in this chapter, and it's our job to look down into that hole and see what the author is wanting us to see. And that is that God is in charge of the whole of this book. But also, in chapter 4, it's not merely that we see God in the background, in charge of the natural history of events, but rather, we also see God very clearly present in the minds of Mordecai and Esther, and perhaps all of the Jews. And that's what I want us to consider this morning then. I want us to see that it wouldn't make sense, this narrative, this chapter wouldn't actually make sense if it wasn't for the fact that the idea of God, that the God of the Jews, was in the minds of Mordecai and Esther and the Jews as these events take place. And so I want us to see then three occasions when it's very clear that God was very present in the minds of Mordecai and Esther and the Jews. And so the first occasion then is to say that God is implied in a petition. He is implied in a petition. So verse 1 of our chapter begins with Mordecai and the Jews having received this decree of their annihilation. As I said, Haman the Agagite has used all of his power and influence and cunning to achieve this officially authorized genocide. And of course, it's initiated by Mordecai's refusal to bow down to Haman. That's what's caused it. And yet, although Mordecai in that way has caused it, Mordecai gives no impression of regret. He's not embarrassed about the fact that he didn't bow down to his enemy. And yet at the same time, he is clearly very emotional. We see this instantaneous outpouring of emotion. Mordecai tears his clothes and he puts on sackcloth and ashes, and many of the other Jews do the same. And suddenly then this man who, to begin with, we sort of see as this stable, undaunted, father-like figure to Esther, is now, in chapter 4, going out into the middle of the city and crying out loud, loudly, bitterly, and coming right up to the king's gate doing that. And of course, he's not the only one. The Jews as well are doing that. Verse 3 tells us that there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And clearly then, Mordecai is making a bit of a public statement, isn't he? I mean, once over, we'd seen how Mordecai had been at first reluctant to identify himself with the Jews, hadn't he? He'd actually told Esther, back in chapter 2, to disguise the fact, to cover up the fact that she was a Jew. But now, well, that reluctance seems to have disappeared. He's not bothered. He's rather going out into the city, publicly identifying himself with these people who it's been decreed will be annihilated. And so think for a moment then, what is Mordecai and what are the Jews doing right now exactly? Why are they weeping and mourning in this way? What is it that Mordecai is trying to do other than get Esther's attention, which I think he is trying to do and he succeeds in doing? But what is also the purpose of Mordecai and the Jews' behaviour as a whole? And what I want to say then is that I want to suggest that there can be little purpose of this orchestrated emotional outcry when we take God out of the picture. The public mourning was a very visible expression of an invisible experience. A very visible expression of an invisible experience. It was the experience of grief. You know, King David himself grieves in this way when he hears of the deaths of King Saul, for instance, or Abner, the commander of the army. He tears his clothes. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. But to whom was this outpouring of grief directed? Well, at first it was an expression which was directed towards yourself, wasn't it? By looking down upon yourself and seeing yourself in these torn, ash-covered clothes, you were reinforcing to yourself the seriousness of your situation. You were not allowing yourself to kind of merely brush it off. No, you were reinforcing the significance of the situation to yourself. It might have been tempting to sort of brush it aside, but that wasn't appropriate. So it was an expression which was directed to yourself. But of course, it was also an expression which was directed to those around you, wasn't it? By seeing your friends and your family grieving in this same way, your own grief is amplified and enabled. Together, you sort of dial up the group consciousness of your activity. You are reminding the group. The group is reminding itself of the serious condition that they're in. But you see, if that's all the public outcry was doing, then it's hard to see what real good it could achieve. Because such an expression would be fundamentally hopeless. I mean, apparently the Persians themselves were familiar with this kind of outpouring of grief. For instance, when the Persians were defeated by the Greeks at the Battle of Salamis, they too tore their clothes in an expression of grief. And of course, it's not unusual in our day and age to see those kinds of expressions ourselves. I mean, still in many countries at funerals, they will hire professional mourners to go along to the funeral and to cry and to wail to get everyone in that state. And yet, those kinds of expressions of grief, well, they only serve as a sort of descending spiral into hopelessness, don't they? They don't have any ultimate hope in them. And yet, I want us to see this morning that in the Jewish case, in Mordecai and the Jews' case, it was very different. It wasn't supposed to be an expression of hopelessness, but rather it was precisely the opposite. Ideally, such an expression was one of hope. And that's because it wasn't merely a vocalization of grief to themselves, but it was a vocalization of grief to the one who might be able to provide a remedy. In short, then, this public mourning, it turned an inner turmoil not just into an outward display, but also into an outward petition. It seems more than a coincidence that the very expression fasting and weeping and lamenting in verse 3 is actually identical to the expression used in Joel chapter 2, verse 12. That's something we read maybe about a year ago now. Joel chapter 2, verse 12 reads this. It says, "Yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments." That phrase, fasting, weeping, and mourning, is identical to the phrase which is used in our passage in verse 3. And God says, "Rend your hearts, not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster." And you see, I think then that without mentioning God's name, the author is perhaps making this little reference to Joel to remind us that ultimately what's going on here is a turning to God. It's a petition to the one God who can remedy their terrible situation that they're now in. The Jews aren't merely rending their garments, but they're also, in the words of Joel, rending their hearts. It's not a purposeless display. Rather, it's a hopeful petition. It's a request that God might be their deliverance, that he might spare them from disaster. I mean, you think of fasting, for instance. I mean, fasting in the Bible can be involve an outward display. I mean, here, it's sort of involved with the weeping and the lamenting. But good fasting in the Bible is first and foremost an expression to God, to be seen privately by him, isn't it? Jesus tells us that when you fast, wash your face and anoint yourself so that you're not really obvious to people, but rather that first and foremost your fasting may be seen by, not by others, but by your Father who is in secret. So fasting, fundamentally, is a God-orientated activity. It's not about getting other people's attention, it's about praying, petitioning to God. And that, then, I want to suggest is exactly what we're seeing in our chapter. The Jews are petitioning God. God is implied in this petition. So that's my first point, then. He is implied in a petition. But secondly, God is implied in a perception. He is implied in a perception. So, via her eunuch Hathach, Esther finally gets Mordecai's message, doesn't she? Mordecai wants Esther to plead with the king over this decree. He wants her to plead with the king on behalf of her people. But in verse 11, she protests that suggestion. And essentially what she says is, look, there's one law for those of us who go to see the king without being invited. Unless he holds out the golden scepter, it's death. And Mordecai, who has been this compassionate father-like cousin to her, delivers what we might think is quite a brutal response. He's essentially saying to Esther, look, if you're worried about dying, you're going to die anyway. But then, in verse 14, he goes on to say these very familiar words, something quite interesting. He says, "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish." And then he says, "And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And of course, these are very, very famous words, and reservoirs of ink have been spilled over these verses. And I'm not intending to say anything dramatically different or revolutionary right now, but I simply want to point out that Mordecai perceives two incredible things. He perceives two incredible things. Firstly, he perceives that the Jews are a protected people. He says deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place. And that expression, another place, is actually a very ambiguous expression. It's very difficult to translate. But it really just goes to show how sort of deliberately our narrator, our author, is trying to avoid mentioning God, isn't it? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, if ultimate deliverance for the Jews is certain, then who could make it certain other than an ultimate deliverer? So Mordecai then, he perceives that the Jews are this fundamentally protected people, and you can't be a fundamentally protected people without a protector. So, as I say then, Mordecai can only be reminding Esther of the God of the Jews, of her God, perhaps a God which at this point in her life has been maybe felt quite remote to her. Maybe she hasn't felt sort of intimately involved with this God of the Jews. And yet, right now, Mordecai is saying to her, well, actually, he is our people's deliverer. So Mordecai perceives then that the Jews are a protected people. But secondly, he perceives that in all things, there is an ultimate purpose. And of course, I'm referring to that famous line at the end of verse 14, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And of course, this is a sentence which absolutely makes no sense without God. You can't have a purpose in the world without a purpose giver. That's essentially what he's saying. He's saying perhaps there is a purpose in you being here right now, but you can't have a purpose without a purpose giver. I mean, people these days will often talk about making your own meaning in life, sort of inventing your own meaning, but it's a fundamentally contradictory statement. Meaning is necessarily imposed upon you. Someone else gives you meaning. Someone else gives you purpose. You can't just generate it yourselves. And so in saying then that perhaps there is this purpose in you being here right now, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this, he's saying that perhaps there is some ultimate transcendent purpose of God. You see, Mordecai, he looks back at the last few years of their lives. He sees the death of Esther's parents, perhaps. Or he sees that beautiful little orphan girl and all of her loveliness and her radiance, and then he sees that day when the officer points at Esther and says, come on, join the harem. And then he sees that painful day when the king takes Esther into the bedroom, and then he remembers that announcement from the king that the king takes favor in his cousin and wants her to be queen. He watches this whole story unfold, you see, as he looks back through time. And then on the one hand, he sees this immense crisis developing, this threat of genocide. And on the other hand, as he sees this story unfold, he realizes that right now he has this orphan cousin, this ally who's behind enemy lines in the very palace of the king himself. And he looks at all of this unfold and he thinks, perhaps there is a purpose in all of this. You see, Joseph, in Genesis chapter 50, could get to the end of the story and he could look back and he could say to his brothers, look, for what you intended for evil, God has intended for good. He could see how God worked all of his intentions through and brought about a situation where through the chaos, God had used the situation to save many, many people from a famine. But Mordecai doesn't have that liberty right now. He doesn't have the full picture yet. He's still part of the story, isn't he? And so all he can do is stand on the verge of history and say, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Perhaps, he asks, this is the moment when something particularly pivotal takes place in the unfolding story. And so he perceives then, he has this perception that history isn't merely a chain of natural events, but rather it's God's own story. From before the creation began, circumstances had been so designed that Esther and Mordecai were in this present situation at this time. And now he asks, perhaps this is where you take a stand, Esther. This is where you do something for God. This is where you take a stand for your people and for your God, and you usher in the new chapter in God's plan. This is perhaps what God has purposed that you do right here, right now. And of course, I don't want to try and misapply this truth to our own situations, but I think we can say that there are moments in our lives where we do sense that perhaps we've reached a bit of a pivotal moment, where we realise that the time has come to act and to play our part in a significant way in God's unfolding plan for us. We can't say for certainty what's going to happen next. We don't know exactly what happens when we do X, Y, or Z. But we can, of course, cling to the promises of God that all things are working together for our good. And our eyes can be especially open to the fact that God is working through our lives purposefully, bringing us moment by moment in accordance with his plan. And so we are at times entitled to ask that question, you know, who knows? Perhaps we are in this particular moment for God's particularly pivotal, special moment in God's plan. And yet, nevertheless, I don't want us to forget that there is a general sense in which Mordecai's words, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this, are appropriate for the whole book of Esther. You see, Esther and Mordecai were living in Susa for such a time as God purposed. Esther was taken into the king's harem for such a time as God purposed. Mordecai overhears an assassination plot for such a time as God had purposed. All things that happened in their lives, every single little detail happened according to God's purposes. That question, who knows whether you or we or I have come to the kingdom for such a time as this, is relevant to the whole story. And again, I don't want to misapply this, because I think we can. I think sometimes we can sort of believe that we can see the direction God's leading us and we can start making predictions about what's going to happen when we do things. And perhaps we can have this unhelpful emphasis that all God wants to do is, you know, change the world through us and use us in some particularly special way to do some wonderful thing. And that can be an unhelpful emphasis at times. But at the same time, I think we do need to remember that God has got his purposes in all that happens in our lives, doesn't he? In every moment of our lives. Whether you are here right now or whether you're on Zoom right now, that is according to God's plan. He has purposed that. And that's not a sort of soft liberal thing to say. No, that's actually a strong biblical statement, which, if anything, is reaffirmed by the Reformed faith. God is the sovereign God of the whole world. Everything which happens, happens for his purposes. You are here for such a time as this. And wherever that might be, your duty in that situation is to do what Esther does and to serve the God who put you there. So that's the truth then that Mordecai perceives or begins to perceive in this chapter. That in all things there is the ultimate purpose of God. So that's my first 2 points then. God is implied in a petition and God is implied in a perception, Mordecai's perception. But thirdly and finally then, God is implied in a priority. God is implied in a priority. So Esther is put on the spot, isn't she? Mordecai basically says to her, yes, Esther, you might die, but you still need to act. And I think it's worth saying again that the godlessness of this story, that is to say, God's name being absent from this story, probably indicates something of the flavour of the whole era for Esther and Mordecai at that time. What I mean is, Esther didn't live in a world where she just sort of expected God could intervene in some miraculous way at any moment. You know, she didn't just expect that when she went into the king's palace and he doesn't hold out the golden sceptre and she's going to be killed, or what actually happens is God at that point intervenes with an angel or a special, you know, burns up the soldiers in a column of fire or drops in and offers her some supernatural protection. I don't think she just has those expectations. It's clear that some people in Scripture, at some times in Scripture, do have those expectations, and we shouldn't limit God's capacity in the slightest. God can act in whatever way he chooses and protect his people in whatever, however dramatic a means he chooses. But that's not what Esther expects, and it's not what Mordecai reassures her with. Mordecai doesn't say, "Oh, you won't die, don't worry, God will miraculously save you." No, Mordecai simply says, "It doesn't matter if you die. You need to serve God anyway." And so then Esther, looking upon her situation, seeing the dilemma she's in, she decides to take that stand for God. She decides to ally herself with him, identify herself with her people, protest her people's plea. And then she says, "If I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish." Verse 16, you see in that verse she asks for a fast. Again, it's a reminder that fasting and petitioning on her behalf are intimately entwined. She asks for this fast, and then she says, "Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Esther then, she finally makes this step and decides to speak for the king, but for what reason? What is Esther actually saying here? What does she mean, "if I perish, I perish"? Is this just some sort of nihilistic, fatalist mentality? Is she just saying, "Well, who cares about me anyway, because it's all meaningless. You know, God's not going to step in. If I die, I die. That's just it. Who cares?" Well, no, she's not saying that. On the contrary, she's not surrendering herself to meaninglessness. What she's actually doing is she's surrendering herself to a higher priority. I said God is implied in a priority, and we see that priority in Esther's thinking right now, because what she's saying is, look, perishing is only perishing because self-preservation isn't the ultimate goal. It's not my ultimate priority. There's more to life than just surviving, not less. And that higher priority then for Esther is obedience and alliance to God and to the people of God. To own God's name and to stand for his beloved people trumps all of her other allegiances. And while the book of Esther is more than just a set of moral examples, in fact, at times Esther and Mordecai don't live up to their examples, and we shouldn't just sort of follow them in all things that they do. Nevertheless, I think we need to be instructed by her example in this case. We need to share in Esther's courageous attitude today. If I perish, I perish. You see, Esther's words are very jarring in today's day and age, aren't they? Today's day and age, they say, well, how can you possibly have a goal beyond self-preservation, beyond living life to the full and enjoying all the good things in life? That's the ultimate priority, family and friends and good things and food and whatever it might be. There's nothing beyond that, so why would you prioritize anything other than that? If your existence here and now is all you'll ever have, then if you value anything above that, you'll lose everything. And so if our day and age would ever say, "If I perish, I perish," they'd only ever mean that in the meaningless sense. The, well, it's all meaningless anyway. If I die, I die. And I want to suggest that it's easy for us as 21st century Christians living in this wealthy part of the world compared to other parts of the world. It's very easy for us to drink in this attitude, isn't it? And to see our lives as the abundance of our possessions. At times we almost expect that God will allow for us to serve him in a way which doesn't require sacrifice, doesn't require giving things up, doesn't require hardships at times. And when hardships come our way, we get bitter about it. And we think, well, actually, no, God owes us, he owes us a good time. The thing is, God doesn't owe us a good time. He doesn't owe us an easy life. The book of Esther tells us that at times God requires us to make significant sacrifices and to prioritize him above all other things. Just remind yourself of Jesus' most challenging words in Mark chapter 8. He says, For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. He's saying there that we need to put him above all things, and we need to be prepared to lose even our very lives for his sake. The God of the Bible owns our lives, and although it frightens us to think it, he does demand us to lay them down, whatever the cost. And yet here, the fourth chapter of Esther, we see that Esther is given the grace of God to do just that. She's not left to her own abilities. Rather, God enables her to make that higher priority, to make that higher commitment. She realizes that she owes her allegiance to something which is a throne which is higher than the throne of the king of Persia. And so I want us to finish then by just reminding ourselves that that's the case for us as well. We owe our lives to a higher throne than the King of England, the Queen of England, the Prime Minister. We have a higher priority than just self-preservation, than just enjoying the good things of life. No, our lives don't consist in the abundance of possessions. They are instruments of God, used to give glory to God and enjoy God by prioritizing God above all things. And so let's finish then by reminding ourselves that we too, like the Jews in this chapter, should petition and perceive and prioritize the invisible will of God above all things. And let's remember once again that he is constantly at work in our lives, whether we recognize it or not, bringing all things together for his good and wonderful plan. And it is a good and wonderful plan, a plan which ultimately glorifies him by saving us. And so we thank God for these things. Amen.